Hi, podcast listeners. This is Brooke. On this episode, I talk art with James Mundy of the Francis Lehman Loeb Center Gallery at Vassar College. We talk all about the American Stories exhibit they're having, which feature artists from the Hudson River School. The exhibit runs through April 17th. Enjoy!
We are on. I am speaking today with James Mundy about the American Stories exhibit at the Francis Lehman Loeb Center, Art Center at Vassar College. So, James, tell me about this collection. Where did it come from?
Well, the Loeb Art Collection has been in existence for 150 years. The core collection was donated by a founding trustee of Vassar College by the name of Elias Magoon. And Magoon was a collector of what was then American contemporary art. He collected the work of the Hudson River School of landscape painters and also some American genre painters. And he knew most of the artists who were in his collection. He put a great store by actually being friendly with them, socializing with them. And that was one of his motivations in collecting. He liked the contact with the artists. He liked knowing where these works came from. So anyway, Magoon also collected works on paper, but most of those were British in origin, and that's a separate collection. So the American Stories begins by drawing more from that original gift of Magoon. We have a number of his works already on view in our permanent galleries, but this special exhibition was meant to delve more deeply into the holdings of the Loeb Art Center, specifically in American painting, and to bring out works which normally don't get much visibility, and to give an indication of the kind of collection that we have, the depth and the breadth of that collection.
Right, right. So I had never heard of the Hudson River Valley art group, and I was real interested in them because they're my people. And so tell me about them. What is special about them?
Well, they, first of all, were the first major distinct manifestation of American visual art. Before this interest in landscape arose in the 19th century, most American painters who were at work were doing things that paid the bills, mostly painting portraits, maybe some history painting, but not much. But with the end of the first third of the 19th century and the arrival of people such as Thomas Cole to this country, who was born in England originally, the view of the American landscape, especially in the Northeast, a landscape that was rapidly changing, was something that inspired a great deal of interest among artists and also among others, such as this Magoon fellow I mentioned to you. He was a minister, and they saw in nature a great spiritual reservoir that they could tap into. So a lot of the sense of the sublime in nature, of the confrontation between small man and big, powerful, God-wrought nature, was motivating to these painters of the landscape. And so they would go out on sketching trips into the hills, around the Hudson River, up into New England, Vermont, and New Hampshire, up to the mountains there, and record things as they found them, often to bring them back to their studio and put them together in these large and kind of sumptuous views of a natural world with very little of man's presence.
Right, right. So would you say this was kind of an act of worship for them?
I think it was spiritual. They were obviously artists who were trained to paint and draw, and that being worshipful of your subject matter off lot of subjects.
Right.
You could be equally worshipful of someone whose portrait you're painting,
right?
Because you're into it at such a level. So I think that while most of these individuals were good old American Protestants and Christians, and found in their subject matter and nature a little more, they found this kind of bigger spiritual environment. I mean, the kinds of things that Ralph Waldo Emerson was writing about, which tend to transcend the specifics of daily religion and became more of a kind of existential, spiritual level. I mean, that's what they were illustrating. Whether they believed in it or not is something else. One of the artists in the exhibition, George Innes, was a follower of this small subset called Swedenborgianism. And it was really rooted in a very synthetic cosmology that was deeply spiritual, but only tangentially, you know, Christian.
Right.
The Swedenborg was a visionary. He wrote tracts that were, he was quite charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a strong following in the U.S., among them, George Innes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed in your exhibition that you also had Georgia O'Keeffe, and I never heard of the Hudson River Valley artists, and I certainly wouldn't have put her in them if I had known about them.
Well, you should understand that the exhibition covers a period from 1800 to 1950.
Mm-hmm.
So the American stories evolve a great deal over that 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the 19th century people, but also we have artists from the turn of the century and those that are at the forefront of new American modernism, like George O'Keeffe and Arthur Dove. And so, and the last painting in the show actually dates from 1952,
mm-hmm.
kind of an example of an artist who was very influenced by French Impressionism.
Mm-hmm.
So these American stories span a lot of time and a lot of stylistic evolution
mm-hmm.
in terms of American art. So it's not just the Hudson River School people.
Right.
They figure to it, but it's not just them.
Right. So can you, I mean, I know you said they're mostly landscapes, or they are all landscapes, but what is the typical style of them, of the Hudson School?
Well, it's as naturalistic as they could possibly make it.
Mm-hmm.
They are composed compositions for the most part, that is.
What does that mean? What is composed?
Well, they do take nature and manipulate it to a certain extent to mm-hmm. make for a better composition.
Mm-hmm.
So they might move a tree, or they might set up a perspective that's a little different than you might see in person.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they kind of tidy up nature occasionally.
Okay.
It's not steam, warts and all, as if you just stumbled into the forest.
Right.
But it is as naturalistic as they could make it in terms of a presentation of how a boulder looks, you know, how the light looks on a fall day when there's a lot of particulate matter in the air and the sun catches that. I mean, they're very careful about some of this firsthand observation and how they convey it in their painting.
Mm-hmm.
So very naturalistic. For some of the works, they are small in size, so it's not as if you feel you're walking into the environment,
mm-hmm.
but they are created with a great deal of care.
Right. And I read, I was reading some about the exhibition and also about the Hudson River School, and I read that art was kind of coming to the middle class, and so they were having access to art as opposed to just the wealthy people. So this kind of was on the forefront of the middle class, or the normal people, the regular people's art.
Well, it's certainly in the case of Magoon, that's true, because he was not a wealthy man.
Mm-hmm.
He therefore could not afford the big paintings that the wealthier New York individuals who were commissioning these works could afford to go into their Fifth Avenue palaces. But he was able to put together a fine collection of small paintings, and often we have correspondence between him and our artists saying, you know, what can you give me for $12?
Mm-hmm.
That type of thing. Mm-hmm. So he was very conscious of economy. He was very thrifty.
Mm-hmm.
And as a minister, he wasn't paid much. He wasn't independently wealthy. So he did the most with what he could and enjoyed a good, solid, middle-class life in Albany, New York. And you know, his house was not grand, but it was chock full of works of art that he could afford.
Right. Right. So, and let's talk, so were all of the artists, they had other jobs. I mean, what were they, talk some about the other artists, like what they did, and, because, I mean, they weren't paid as an artist. They weren't making their money from their art, were they?
Yeah, they were.
Okay.
I mean, they were supporting themselves. I mean, it depends on who we're talking about, but most of the artists in the exhibition were able to support themselves.
Oh, okay.
I mean, some did teach.
Mm-hmm.
People like William Merritt Chase, you know, were very successful teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it because he liked to do it, not because he depended on the paycheck.
Right.
And even some of the Hudson River School artists of lesser reputation managed to make a living at it.
Cool.
It wasn't always, you know, a great living. But those who couldn't make a living usually just dropped out and did something else.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't do both.
Right, right. So
you couldn't wait on tables and be an artist like you can today.
Yeah, yeah. So talk some about how the invention of the camera or photographs affected the art world, or their livelihoods, I guess.
It certainly affected it in many ways. Many artists, as soon as photography was introduced in 1839, and in this country in 1840, by one of America's more important painter, Samuel F. B. Morse, was an artist by profession. He was also an inventor, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But he painted both portraits, landscapes, history scenes, and he introduced the daguerreotype process into mm-hmm. into the States. And it was received, you know, very quickly by many, mostly those who again wanted to have their portraits made. So one of the unfortunate byproducts was that it put some painters out of business,
right,
who no longer could be the only source of portraits, especially the miniature portraits,
mm-hmm.
that were very often exchanged between people. That whole thing evaporated after the introduction of photography, because now you get something of the same size, you know, daguerreotype, that was an absolute, you know, perfect image of the sitter. So on that front, it had a deleterious effect on art. But then, by the same token, artists began to see the opportunities,
right,
of taking photographs and using them as important components to their painting. We have one artist in the exhibition named Ben Chong, who was a painter in this country in the pre-World War II period. He was active mostly from 1925 through the 50s. And Chong was also a photographer for the Armed Security Administration, arm of the New Deal, mm-hmm. during the 1930s, and he traveled the country and recorded Americans doing their jobs them living their lives, you know, at the, you know, basis levels, you know, the poor, poverty-stricken in the countryside,
right.
the urban factory workers, you name it, he traveled and recorded it
right.
with his camera for the WPA. And eventually, he was always a painter by inclination. Eventually, he included many of those photographs as points of reference for his painting
mm-hmm.
later on. And so he was one artist who made extensive use of the photographic image for his painting. And that gave him some freedom to move away from pure realistic depiction into more creative presentations.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's cool. There's a change because I know there was one time when they were just portraying just the ordinary, not the everyday stuff. It's just kind of like portraits and dress up for it for your picture, but you wouldn't get the mundane everyday kind of stuff. And I think that's more interesting. So, and I can definitely see how I think that as much as photography would have destroyed some of some artists' livelihood, it would have definitely helped a lot as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's pretty consistent, and it still does. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of painters depend on photographs to help them convey something. A lot of them combine images. Rooted in photography. It's a good way to take notes about the environment that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. So what is, as a curator, what was your process throughout this whole exhibition?
Well, it was a simple one, really, and not terribly deep, I have to say. We were anxious, especially during the winter period, when our visitation is not as large as during the spring and summer and fall, that we draw on our permanent collection and basically bring out works that should be seen but rarely get to be seen. So given that premise, then, and focusing on, in this case, just American painting, the idea was to select a body of work, in this case 58, 59 works, that would hold together in some fashion. So the arbitrary divisions in three that we did here, a section on people, a section on places, and a section on moments, corresponded to our three temporary exhibition galleries.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a chapter in each one. And then I simply tried to create an environment among those works where certain ones seem to be almost talking to one another, that sometimes works in the same gallery seem to have many things in common, many things that you can compare and contrast. So the presentation of these works was preceded by some thought to how they might have a conversation among themselves or how they might stimulate a conversation in the visitors. So it's a kind of, in this particular case, and in my approach to organizing an exhibition, it's a organic one.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go into it necessarily with a premeditated message,
mm-hmm.
but you help to build that message as the installation process proceeds, and you anchor it to a few basic ideas. And in this case, it was a very broad survey, but the point is to present works that have some teaching moments attached to them,
mm-hmm.
and that can give the visitor some richer texture for what it is to live in America and be surrounded by artists who are still trying to summon the essence of the American experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you were talking about starting conversations. What kind of conversations were these artists hoping to start back in their time?
I wish I could speak for them. Can't really. I think one important thing about the 19th century artists is that they were very socially cohesive. Mm-hmm. They belonged to clubs together, sketching clubs and social clubs. They had their studios in the same buildings. They interacted personally with one another all the time. They corresponded with one another all the time. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the lone wolf kind of artist, mm-hmm. slaving away in his studio
right.
by himself, really wasn't the case at all. They had great parties together. They had good times. Their families knew one another. They turned out for each other's memorial services and mm-hmm. exhibitions. I think that was the biggest difference. There was a very important social component among some of these earlier groups of artists.
Any kind of tension, like jealousy or anything like that?
Oh, I suppose. that's only natural.
Right, right.
I mean, you had that since Michelangelo and Raphael. But I think that the strength of their cohesiveness really was much more important. I mean, there's one artist who is actually not in the exhibition, but has had a recent exhibition of his own in the region, called Jervis McEntee. Mm-hmm. And Jervis McEntee was not hugely successful, but he was a very good artist, and he was highly thought of by his artistic colleagues, his painterly colleagues mm-hmm. in the 19th century. And his portrayals of landscape were not always the kind of rich autumn days, you know, filled with color and sunlight, but he had a much more somber approach to nature.
Right.
A melancholic character. But his artist friends helped support him very often. They would, you know, he worked in Kingston, New York. He came to New York City on occasion, but he couldn't afford some of the life qualities that some of his peers had. And so they looked out for him. You know, they made sure his paintings were exhibited in New York City. They wrote to him describing how they were exhibited. They, you know, helped him with funds when he needed it. And so it was that kind of thing that you see much more in evidence than professional jealousies.
Right.
And the kind of research that I've done.
Right. That's really interesting. It's kind of a different time, I guess.
It was, yeah.
So that's really cool. So what other kind of exhibitions do you have coming up?
Well, the next one is a spring exhibition opening in April on astronomy in art.
Nice.
How the heavenly bodies have been portrayed not only historically, but this one will focus more on modern and contemporary artists and their look at astronomy. And this goes hand in hand with the dedication of the new science center at Vassar that will open in the spring.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, this is awesome. This has been really fun. I really enjoyed talking to you, James.
Good. Well, I'm glad I could help, and best of luck with your coming podcasts and all the endeavors, and I hope you'll give me a link when you have one set up.
Yes, absolutely. I'll email it to you, and I'll definitely be in touch. I'll definitely be in touch. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brooke.
Talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I think this is another great podcast. Thank you so much to James Mundy for chatting with me, and thank you so much for listening. As always, if you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, you have ideas for future podcasts or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. Show yourself, please contact me at letstalkartwithbrooke@gmail.com.